sexual misconduct allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill. Legislative leaders meet on the DCS report, that plus Donnelly in the Supreme Court, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending July 6th, 2018.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, allegations surfaced that Attorney General Curtis Hill groped three legislative staffers and a lawmaker at a party in March.
Republican leaders David Long and Brian Bosma learned of the accusations in May when the lawmaker reported the alleged misconduct. They initiated an investigation into their own liability as employers. A report was prepared by an outside attorney. It found legislative leaders aren't liable because Hill is not a member of the legislative branch. The report urged Bosma and Long to discuss the allegations with Hill. They did so, and a joint statement from all four legislative caucus leaders said the matter is resolved, quote, to the satisfaction of the employees involved. Days later, Governor Eric Holcomb and Republican legislative leaders joined the growing number of voices calling for Hill to step down. Hill defiantly rejected such calls and has denied the allegations. He also questions the fairness of the investigation.
Will Curtis Hill resign? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and our new full-time panelist, we welcome Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette State House reporter Nikki Kelly. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, does Hill have, now he is, we just learned before we started taping that Attorney General Curtis Hill sent out a statement in which he's doubled down. He says the investigation was not done properly. He's calling for a special prosecutor, or actually the Marion County prosecutor, to investigate this case fully. He believes he will be exonerated. He says he's not resigning, but does he really have much choice at this point?
I don't think so. I mean, look at what happened. We know an incident occurred several months ago, and we know after a lapse of time, a lawmaker came forward to all four of the leaders of the legislature, and we know that the legislative leaders hired outside counsel to look at their potential liability in this particular case and determined that there was no liability under Title VII for the conduct that occurred. And then they were prepared to sweep that under the rug. Nothing was done with that, even though the recommendation was to confront Curtis Hill with it and tell him that this conduct would not be tolerated. Nothing was done with that until there was a leak and a whistleblower released the memo, and then contemporaneous with that release of the memo, they confronted Curtis Hill in a phone call, and then said they were not going to do anything further with this, but they were going to get that whistleblower. They were going to get that whistleblower. Then it blows up because it's all over the newspaper, and it's egregious conduct, and all of a sudden we get from willingness to sweep it under the rug to calling for his resignation. Now, is it on the same exact facts that they were willing to sweep it under the rug on before, or have more people come forward? I don't know the answer to that question. But in my experience, having done sex offense prosecutions for a long time, you don't start this conduct at his age. So we'll see if anyone else comes forward. As a general rule, it isn't the first time. So we'll see what happens here. But he's chosen to fight. And yes, I have it on a very good informed source in the legislature that they're exploring the possibility of impeachment.
I wonder who that source was.
The same one quoted by name in the paper?
let me ask this. If there's a greater fight, at this point, the governor, legislative leaders from both parties have all called for him to resign, as have members of Congress and just about anybody who's been asked about it at this point. If he remains defiant, is a fight going to look good?
Well, I don't think he can. He can't. The point here is that he cannot effectively serve as the state's chief law enforcement officer as attorney general with this hanging over him. And I understand his claims that this has been unfair and he's lacked due process. That is not the standard by which you are held to when you are an elected official. This is as much a political exercise and just an exercise in what's right and what's not. And the bar is much higher for you to represent all Hoosiers, you know, in that situation. So he can't effectively serve. The only option here is for him to step down. I think Republican leadership is in lockstep on that right now, given the evidence.
Following John Zodi's example, calling for his resignation.
Well, it's easy when you're the opposition party to be the first one out the gate saying he's got to resign while everybody else is trying to figure out what actually happened, right? And I think legislative leaders did the right thing in their role. We're kind of mixing up two processes here. One was the legislature's obligation as an employer to these young people and the lawmaker who stepped up and made and went public on Friday.
Okay,
so I think that changes a lot of this when you have a face with an accusation and an elected official.
Maybe, but if you're the legislative leaders, particularly the Republicans, because the governor and Republican legislative leaders took 3 days between these becoming public and saying he's got to go. But if at least the Republican legislative leaders knew for weeks before that what these accusers were saying, and they say they believe them, so I don't know if they didn't believe them and now they do, but is 3 days a good look?
Well, I guess it's the old adage, things look different when they're on the front page of the newspaper. And the other advice that you hear young politicians often given from more seasoned individuals is don't do anything you wouldn't want to see on the front page of fill in the blank, whatever paper is in that area. That does, by definition, change everything, the framework. When it becomes a public issue and no longer a personnel issue, the rules of engagement change dramatically. Now, that's not to say they morally shouldn't have acted earlier. I guess if they found it repugnant conduct on day whatever, 30 days passed,
yeah,
they probably should have found it repugnant earlier on as well. But keep in mind also, this is not happening in a vacuum. No story unfolds in a vacuum, especially in the political arena, but this is against the backdrop of the Me Too movement.
Yeah.
And
a different climate
the
than
New
we've
York
seen
Attorney
before.
General.
And the New York
yeah,
Attorney General.
Attorney
so,
General.
I mean, in media, is just as guilty as any other profession, where we've seen a sort of emphasis on conduct and issues in a way we've never witnessed, certainly in my life.
Nikki, you asked the question on Twitter last night. If the memo that got leaked never becomes public, do these calls for resignation happen? So do these calls for resignation happen?
My inclination is no, just judging by their initial statement that the four leaders put out, which was very kind of ho-hum. Like, we looked into it, we've addressed it with the Attorney General and to the employees to their satisfaction.
Yeah.
And they said,
we're not
commenting anymore. Yeah. So judging from that, I think it definitely took the pressure on social media and in other media formats for them to feel that they had to make a decision.
You know, there's some white light here for Curtis Hill, because after you had the president out there in Montana poo-pooing the Me Too movement, there probably is a place for him in the Trump-Pence administration. The fact that he's an abuser, sexual harasser, probably is a plus. Well,
time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should Attorney General Curtis Hill resign in the wake of sexual misconduct allegations against him? A, yes, or B, no? I wonder how that one will go. Last week's question: should the U.S. Senate vote on a replacement for Justice Anthony Kennedy before the midterm elections? 32% say yes, 68% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana Republican House Speaker Brian Bosma said this week he's, quote, disturbed previous administrations ignored reports on the Department of Child Services. Many of the recommendations from a recent independent evaluation of DCS were also in past reports that went unheeded. House Speaker Brian Bosma says he didn't even know about one such report given to the Pence administration. Bosma says he's confident this administration won't drop the ball. Democratic Senator Karen Tallien isn't so confident. She says she doesn't think many of the questions surrounding DCS will be answered in the short term. Legislative study committees will examine DCS issues in the coming months. Mike O'Brien, is it important? The governor said after the report came out that he's looking forward, and obviously that's important. But is it also important to understand why the past reports were ignored?
I think it's important as they move forward into implementation of the recommendations that if one of these recommendations is a repeat and there was a deliberate decision to not go down that road, maybe why? Why was there a legitimate reason that they discover maybe it was a bad fit with this system, that it actually wasn't going to benefit caseworkers or the children being protected? But I don't think it's useful to go relitigate the decisions of previous administrations. You know, Governor Holcomb has said, this is on my watch, this is a transparent, months-long process of getting to this point. There's no reason to go relitigate the politics of, you know, four, six, eight years ago with these previous reports.
Was Brian Bosma throwing Mike Pence under the bus a little bit here?
You know, since they've established this department, okay, we've had the same thing over and over again. We've had a complete reluctance on the part of the Republicans in control to look at the systemic problems with this, okay? And the reason is, until the opioid crisis started affecting the middle class, these were all poor kids, okay? And this was not a high priority for them. It just wasn't. When your whole agenda is to cut corporate taxes and not have money to do anything the state should be doing, this is not a high priority. We've been saying for years that the problems with this stem from the fact that we don't pay those employees enough, and we don't have enough of those employees to do what needs to be done. And one of the responses here is to change the way we calculate the number of clients so that the numbers look better, rather than addressing the systemic problems that cause this. All they do periodically when something pops up like this is put a Band-Aid on it. They don't ever fix it, because this has never been a priority, and they're not willing to put the money in it to do what needs to be done.
We put a lot of money in it the last couple of years.
Yeah, and then they take it out. Then they take it out, too.
I don't know if they're going to.
The reason the agency only exists because Republicans created it, because they carved it out of a huge bureaucracy, and so we could focus on it.
Ever since it's been a disaster. Ever since it's been a disaster.
The political will to create the agency to begin with was because it was a disaster. We had the worst caseloads in the country.
And it is a disaster still.
And we still have the worst caseloads.
Exactly. We have much higher caseloads than
I asked him, is it important, should we look at why these past reports were ignored? I'll ask you, will there be a serious look at why these past reports were ignored? Are we going to just kind of move forward wholeheartedly?
I think we're moving forward to look at implementation. That's definitely the way it's going. But, I mean, to bring up the money issues, and to me that's a very important thing for them to get a handle on, because the budget's coming up. They have indeed put in a huge amount of money. I mean, $400 million additional just for this biennium alone outside the appropriation. But the point is they've been taking that from all these one-time pots. At some point, they're going to have to decide what is the baseline for this agency to accurately and efficiently, you know, protect kids. And I think it's going to be pretty high, and I don't know if we're going to bring in enough revenue to, you know, be able to...
Well, it's at least good timing to have that discussion. We're in that part of the budget process. Mm-hmm.
Karen Tanian said she doesn't think a lot of the unanswered questions, and there are, of course, unanswered questions about this, but she thinks a lot of them won't get answered, at least not in the short term. Is it almost impossible to do so in the relative short term?
Probably. And who's to say you can ever find out what was in the heads of the decision makers about what policy tweak was or wasn't made? So I do think, for the most part, there will be a push to look forward. But in many ways, I see this, the handling of this issue in some ways as analogous or parallel to the issue we talked about a moment ago. It's one thing when the issue is not the front burner issue in the court of public opinion. Once Mary Beth Bonaventura, the former head of the agency, came forward and put forth her very inflammatory letter, resignation letter about, that's what thrust this into the public's consciousness. There certainly were problems in the past and tragedies in the past that received some attention, but never was it the kind of, you know, everything litigated and all of the decisions made under the glaring light of the public spotlight. And so I think the dynamic is dramatically different now compared to what it was when those other decisions were made.
All right. Well, President Trump met this week with several people on his short list for the U.S. Supreme Court, including a Hoosier, Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Trump nominated Barrett to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals last year. She was confirmed by the Senate despite pushback from groups concerned she would roll back protections for women, minorities, and the LGBT community. Barrett is a Notre Dame Law School graduate and former law school professor. One of the senators who supported her nomination to the Seventh Circuit, Indiana incumbent Democrat Joe Donnelly, who said at the time she was qualified for the post. Donnelly and other key lawmakers met with the president earlier this week. Donnelly says he urged Trump to nominate someone in the mold of retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy, a more moderate voice on the court.
John Schwanis, is Trump nominating Barrett Joe Donnelly's worst or best case scenario?
In some ways, I'm eager to hear everybody's opinions, because I'm guessing we'll see a division of opinion. But I think it could, because of her Hoosier background, and he, if there's one consistency in his decision making over the years on votes, even as say something like the Affordable Care Act, where the one thing early on that he was most concerned about was the impact on the medical device manufacturers in Indiana. That's always been the fallback position for him. What does this, either what does it do to my constituents in Indiana, or how can I help my constituents in Indiana? So that, if nothing else, I think that the Hoosier connection gives him political cover.
Yeah, does that make it a little easier for Joe Donnelly? If the president nominates someone who he has personally supported just last year, does it make it easier for him to vote for her?
Oh, well, I mean, he's kind of pinned himself into a corner. I mean, if you voted for her a year ago and said she was qualified as an appellate court judge, then it's hard to make any argument against that. And he has this delicate balance that he has to walk between, you know, moderate Democrat and trying to attract some Republican votes. And so this one will be the vote that everyone watches for November.
I don't think he can vote for anybody on that list. And the reason is that with Gorsuch, they were replacing Scalia, both conservative. You're now replacing a moderate, all right? And nobody on that list is a moderate. None of them will protect Roe v. Wade. None of them will protect the LGBT community. None of them will protect immigrants or affirmative action or anything else. And you're talking about the direction the Supreme Court goes for the next generation, okay? Going on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals is one thing. And by the way, she may be living in Indiana. She's still not admitted to the Indiana bar. But she's, you know, the fact that she's from here, from Notre Dame, I think makes her a problem for Trump. If he wants to appeal to the evangelicals, she's nominally Catholic, and on top of that, she's a woman, both of which might be disqualifiers to some of that base support of his. I don't think he can vote for anybody on that list. I think we need a moderate, or every Democrat should withhold their vote.
And that is, and Joe Donnelly apparently in that conversation with President Trump said he's looking for a moderate. He doesn't appear like he'll get one from that list. I don't think anybody would consider them moderate, certainly not in the Anthony Kennedy mold. But will that matter? Will Joe Donnelly have to vote for Amy Coney Barrett if she's the nominee?
Yeah, he's completely screwed here. And there's not much analysis beyond that. I mean, if you can look at it both ways, he is actively trying to go recruit moderate Republicans who Trump is still popular with. I mean, Trump has maintained his popularity in Indiana among, you know, throughout this, you know, these last 18 months. And so he's got to decide whether he's going to double down and alienate his base further, who already are unenthusiastic about electing him, or he's got to bail on these Republicans who he's trying to do what's right.
Back to what I was saying, of the three people on the table now, that is the best scenario, I think, for Joe Donnelly. Oh.
Because then she's from Notre Dame, she's a Hoosier, I support her. If
he's trying to work himself into a yes vote, those are good answers.
Yeah.
I mean, those are at least things that he can justify, right. But it's not going to sell with
this. He needs a no vote.
End family separation. That was the message of hundreds gathered in Indianapolis this week, one of dozens of such events across the state and the country to protest the Trump administration's immigration policies.
Hundreds gathered outside the statehouse and held signs. Messages included "closed minds cause closed borders" and "cribs, not cages." Some of the speakers noted, though, that attending a rally isn't enough. They urged action, including votes this November. Other speakers urged Indiana Senators Joe Donnelly and Todd Young to reject funding for the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement until the family separation policy is permanently ended.
Nikki Haley, we've talked on the show before about whether the civic engagement we've seen since President Trump took office would have staying power. Were this week's protests a sign that they do have some staying power?
I think we've seen the populace is more engaged than ever in what's going on, especially in D.C. And we've seen it through this rally and others earlier this year on women's rights. The real test is November, and we see whether that's going to, you know, translate into votes.
Do you think it's going to continue to last? I mean, this is more than a year now.
Yeah, although this issue, I think, is not the run-of-the-mill issue that we've seen. This one galvanized any number of factions, those who normally would not look over and see those people standing next to them because of political affiliation or background. This seemed to be the one issue that, to a certain extent, was able to transcend a political affiliation, it seemed to me. So maybe it's not a totally accurate
indicator of whether this, how the staying power of that populism.
A lot of the speakers had this message, which was, we're glad you're here. The signs you made are cute. But we're going to need a lot more than showing up to a rally in June or July. How much can we read into, yes, there have been a lot of attendance at these sort of protests, a lot of engagement across the board, but do we think it's going to turn into votes in November?
We'll see. I mean, on there's passionate people on both sides of this debate. I mean, you could argue Donald Trump is only president because of the passion of pro-border security people in 2016 that showed up and were motivated on that issue and continue to be motivated on that issue. So being able to sustain any of this is tough, but this issue in particular I think is unique because people are so passionate about it. It is so personal with so many people. So, but I think the problem that where Democrats need to win in Indiana to make inroads, and I think the only measure of success here are two things. One is does Joe Donnelly get reelected, and two is do they break the super majorities or cut into the majorities, Republican majorities at the State House. It's going to be people are motivated to show up in Marion County, they're motivated by a national message. That's really hard to translate to a State House race.
Oh, I don't know. When you talk about having Republicans in control of everything, and then you look at the chaos we have. We have children being separated from their parents, and now we have to have them incarcerated longer so that we can do DNA testing because they're not sure where they all are. I mean, that's bad enough. And then read something the other day that the path to citizenship for immigrants coming here had always been to go to the military. And now they're throwing out these immigrants. The same, we've had immigrants that were not citizens.
And that's garnering even more.
It will, because we've had immigrants that have died for this country in an effort to become citizens. And these people are here legally, because they have to be in the military, and he's throwing them out of the military. So I think those issues have staying power.
Well, Indiana Young Democrats this week won a bid to host the 2019 National Young Democrats Convention.
The Young Democrats of America hasn't gathered in Indiana in more than 25 years. More than 900 people are expected to attend in mid-July 2019. As the Indiana organization makes this splash, State Democratic Party Chairman John Zodi says the party is focused on recruiting the next generation of political activists. Indiana Democrats have a record number of candidates this fall, including a record number of women running for office.
No, there were some votes against it, but it was Mike O'Brien. For a party looking to build its bench, how significant is the Young Democrats winning this convention bid?
I think it's good. Yeah, I think it's good when you can get that kind of young energy. One, to Indianapolis, because it says a lot about the city and how we have marketed ourselves to a lot of different audiences for a lot of different conventions. Yep. But Democrats need a bench here. We're a better party when the Democrats are strong too, and we just need more young people engaged in politics on both sides of the aisle.
2019 will be a year when it's only local municipal elections, nothing at the state level. Mm-hmm. How important will this be to kind of keep up momentum that Democrats might?
Very important. It's a huge shot in the arm for the Young Democrats in Indiana, huge, and for John Zodi. So it's a big thing, and it'll generate enthusiasm, and also, as Mike says, it helps the convention business in Indianapolis, which is also a good thing.
Yeah. How important was this for them to secure, especially someone like John Zodi?
Oh, I think it's a big win for him. But it also helps that no one throws a convention like Indianapolis.
That's true.
Does this say more about the party
and
structure?
And Fort Wayne and Evansville. I mean, we've got some nice convention centers.
Does this say a little bit more about Indianapolis as a convention destination or is the party structure?
I guess you couldn't have one without the other, but I think the reputation as a very skilled, very well-organized convention town that knows how to do these sorts of events and do them well certainly was a big driver.
Well, it'll be in the middle of summer, so pack cool clothing. Finally, Indiana State Police announced a big drug bust this weekend with 129 arrests made over a two-week period in June. And some of the drugs seized were, quote, Trump-shaped ecstasy pills. The orange pills have the likeness of the president's head on one side with the words great again on the other. Ann Delaney, what side effects do Trump-shaped pills have?
Is this a remake of The Agony and the Ecstasy or something? I tell you, I can't envision anybody voluntarily taking these pills, even without his likeness on the front of it. So, if these are Trump voters, they may not be around in November.
They're supporting
when the time
president
comes.
No matter what. Is that what the message? The excitement for President Trump in Indiana?
it just speaks to the marketing power of making America great again in this country.
By taking drugs.
It seems to me
great.
If his likeness was going to be on some generic medication, this wasn't the one it was going to be.
Careful. Careful now. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.